This is DomesticPreparedness.com. Since 1998, Domestic Preparedness has been a source of solutions for the professional preparedness community. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morton.
This audio interview is sponsored by Avon Protection Products. With a 100-year history of industry-defining innovations, Avon provides trusted respiratory protection to more frontline forces worldwide with the M53 and C50 CBRN gas masks and the Viking ST and ST53 SCBAs. For more information, visit www.avon-protection.com to see why more military, law enforcement, and homeland security personnel trust Avon Protection Products.
Domestic Preparedness is with Director John Clark of the U.S. Marshals Service. Mr. Clark has over 20 years' experience with the Marshals Service, both as a Deputy Marshal and as the U.S. Marshal. He became Director of the Service last year after serving as the U.S. Marshal for the Eastern District of Virginia. Prior to becoming a Marshal, he served in the U.S. Capitol Police and Border Patrol. So he brings to his position as Director extensive federal law enforcement experience in the field. Mr. Clark, thank you for taking time to talk to us today. It's a beautiful day out here, and we have a great view of the U.S. Capitol out your windows.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, sir, let's start with my asking you the broad question of what is of direct interest to our core domestic preparedness membership. What are some of the key ways that the U.S. Marshals Service supports state and local law enforcement as regards to homeland security and disaster preparedness?
Well, you know, the Marshals Service traditionally has had such a broad law enforcement nexus and mission that goes along hand-in-hand with our state and local law enforcement partners out there. But specifically, you know, our Special Operations Group, for example, works extensively with various law enforcement organizations on the disaster preparedness. Hurricane Katrina comes to mind. Our Technical Operations Group, which supports a lot of the interoperability and technical structure with our law enforcement partners, also is well-versed in helping and working with our local partners out there. And, you know, from time to time, the Attorney General directs us to go out and handle certain operations that kind of fall into that that divide, if you will, between some other organization perhaps is not well suited to handle it, so they'll call the marshals in to provide some level of law enforcement response. Hurricane Katrina comes to mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this segment, I want to look at the Marshals Service and the interagency interfaces. Domestic Preparedness makes a point of addressing issues to do with the interagency and intergovernmental linkages, and I'd like to hear first how you fit into those linkages at the federal level here in Washington. For example, you play a role in the Homeland Security Council. Talk to us about that and any other interagency Homeland Security efforts underway.
Well, organizations like the Homeland Security Council and other organizations that we perhaps participate in, you know, as we protect the third branch of government, one of our primary missions here in the Marshals Service. That is a significant responsibility when you think about, preparedness and being able to execute a good Cooper Cog plan, being able to make sure our third branch of government operates well. So our interaction with councils and other domestic preparedness organizations is very key. It's an information sharing point for us. It allows us to exchange ideas and to be aware of how other agencies fit into this process.
Now, how about the interfaces with the Capitol Police and ICE, the Secret Service, and the Border Patrol? I mean, there are some 30 federal law enforcement entities, and how well do you work together, and where are some of the places you intersect?
Well, you know, we pride ourselves on working very, very closely with our federal law enforcement counterparts. In fact, in a post 9/11 world, we really can't survive without working closely with organizations such as the Capitol Police and ICE and FBI, Secret Service, and others. And we meet regularly with individuals at both our field operations level, and of course here in Washington to make sure that we are communicating well, exchanging information well, We know each other on a first name basis and try to interact at a level that is very personal, so that if, as we like to say, the fire alarm rings, we know who our counterparts are in those agencies.
Now, in terms of Washington, you have a role with the National Capital Region. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, there's a number of things we do here in the National Capital Region. One particular thing that we're very proud of is our Capital Area Regional Fugitive Task Force, which in times of domestic preparedness, that is to say some crisis that would strike the region, would certainly be a very integral part of responding to and helping with that. This fugitive task force is comprised of local, state, federal law enforcement agents and officers and sheriff deputies from the surrounding Washington National Capital Area. And these are individuals who, again, work very, very closely on a daily basis and who have that very much, we'd say, a first name operating basis. And so we're very, very pleased of that relationship here in the National Capital Region.
Well, what's been the great success story? The Washington area sniper case, for example?
Well, we look at success stories perhaps not just on an individual basis, although that Washington area sniper case was a great example of interagency cooperation. Where we find that to be strongest around the land is really in a couple of our missions. One of the fugitive apprehension area, we have had in recent times here a great success with operations that we have called the Falcon Operations, which stands for Federal and Local Cops Organized Nationally. Through efforts of Falcon operations and other fugitive apprehension efforts, this last year we set another record within the Marshals Service. And I say we, I'm including our state and local federal counterparts, apprehending over 90,000 state, local, federal fugitives. Additionally, we talk about success in the international community with over 700 international extraditions completed last year. Again, a record-setting time for us, which indicates, of course, that cooperation is strong, very, very strong, but the key to our success in this is truly a joint effort.
Let's talk in this segment about the Marshals Service and the intergovernmental interfaces. What kind of routine assistance can the U.S. Marshals Service offer to the state and local police agencies beyond what you've just discussed?
Well, you know, there's a number of things that we might bring to bear that could help state and local agencies. For example, we are often assisting them in technology areas, for example, on major violent crime incidents or fugitive apprehension situations where we have technologies that we might be able to deploy to help local law enforcement, and particularly where individuals have crossed state lines and a jurisdiction may have trouble going beyond a state line. So that is one thing. We also, in the area of threat management, threats to the judiciary or many state and local sheriff's departments, police departments that handle threats to public officials, the Marshals Service has been and is still developing a strong expertise in mitigating threats to public officials. In our case, it's specifically the judiciary, that is, the judges, mostly at the federal level. But we're also pleased to share information with our state and local counterparts as well.
Now, you mentioned the fugitive apprehension. Can you drill down a little bit deeper as to the assistance that the Marshals Service gives the state and local law enforcement on those cases or any other particular cases?
Sure. You know, just like in the days of old when the Marshals deputized someone to help them in a particular matter, that's still done today, believe it or not. We still deputize state and local police and sheriff's officers to be able to assist in fighting, combating violent crime, and to actually be made special deputy U.S. Marshals. That gives them the broader authority to work outside their own jurisdictional boundary. And by doing that, there is truly no safe haven for those who prey on the most innocent among us, the violent criminals, the type that we all want to apprehend. So that's one way that we provide that sort of federal assistance. And through our regional task forces and our district task forces, we have strong membership from the state, local, federal community that ties all these resources together in one place so that everybody truly shares the area of expertise that they bring to the table. And so we're very, very pleased with that.
Director Clark, what's involved for the Marshal Service to transport prisoners for state and local agencies? What are the fees and conditions? I think there was some aspect of that that was relevant with Hurricane Katrina. You did a lot of support there.
Sure. For example, in Hurricane Katrina, we were able to move a number of prisoners in the greater New Orleans metro area, as well as southern Mississippi, to places where they could actually find incarceration centers because of the devastation, the broad devastation there. And so we used our prisoner transportation aircraft, as the movie sort of depicts the Con Air role, although that is quite the fictitious model. It's not anything like that. But we used our series of aircraft to move them. And as I mentioned earlier, each year we conduct a few hundred extraditions. Many of them are for state and local cases that the federal government is assisting with either through prosecution or just helping that jurisdiction get somebody back to justice. And that is literally from places all over the world. So, we do, because it does cost money, provide some nominal fee, depending, again, on the extent of the extradition, but definitely cheaper than what a local law enforcement entity could do if they were doing it on their own. And so we've really gotten it down to a quite efficient process.
Mm-hmm. Is there an MOU or an MOA that stands between the agency and each jurisdiction, or how does that work?
No, there's not really any MOU or MOA. We do it on a case-by-case basis. From time to time, depending on the nature of the case, we can't do it, although we like to be very can-do and supportive to be able to do it. But there right now, at least, are no policies that would direct that or MOAs.
Now, what are the procedures for state and local jails to house federal prisoners? Is there a payment involved there? And also, what are the conditions?
We contract quite extensively with state and local jails all across the country. If you think for a moment that the federal government, the Bureau of Prisons, of course, incarcerates people on the long-term care, but for individuals who have not yet been had their cases adjudicated or been determined to be found guilty and sentenced, those inmates almost also must be provided care for. So we contract with hundreds of state and local jails all across the country. And essentially, we enter into an agreement with them, a contract, to provide a daily per diem rate to pay that local facility, essentially what it costs to feed and house and care for an inmate. And currently, as we speak, we have about 57,000 federal inmates around the country that are in the care and custody of some local or regional jail. And so we could not survive without those kinds of partnerships.
What is the Marshal Service doing to better communicate with the state and local police agencies?
Well, wherever we can, gather with them and meet with them to talk about these issues of cooperation and collaboration and interoperability. We do that. Like to participate in any types of seminars, conferences that we can so that we can meet with them on a regular basis. At the local level, many, if not all, of our field offices have regular meetings and contacts with the state and local police agencies with the goal in mind to make that level of communication so strong and so good that whenever anything happens in that local jurisdiction, everybody knows each other's role and responsibility, and more importantly, they know each other's name.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your role with the JTTFs. What do you folks bring to the table in that forum?
Well, while the Marshal Service traditional role does not involve extensive terrorism or counterterrorism work, we nonetheless have an interest in knowing about any kinds of things that are out there in the Joint Terrorism Task Forces that might have an effect on our missions, particularly in protecting the third branch of government. So we have what we bring to the table is that knowledge of our daily working with the third branch, the issues that come up with our fugitive apprehension and the kinds of things that we might want to know about regarding particular cases or fugitives, wanted people. And so we share as much as we can our data and resources at the Joint Terrorism Task Force and provide as much information as we can for them to use as well. So it's a good two-way street. We try to give as much as we get from them.
Well, in this segment, let's indeed talk about information sharing. It's always an area of interest to the state and local folks in law enforcement. The Marshals Service is building up its Threat Analysis and Intelligence Center. Now, how does that work here lash up with the similar efforts by the Customs and Border Protection, TSA, and other federal-level law enforcement agencies? And how is what you do different?
Well, it's a great question. Our Threat Analysis and Intelligence Center is going to be aimed primarily at gathering information and doing analysis on threats to the judiciary, where many of the fusion centers or other intelligence centers around the nation have the broader context of homeland security and intelligence gathering, that is to say, from the standpoint of terrorism threats. We, of course, would be interested in those types of threats as well, but our analysis and intelligence center is really built on the concept of gathering and using information that would help us analyze threats made to a federal judge or someone under our area of responsibility for protection. So it is somewhat different in that regard.
Well, now, is it a two-way street for information sharing between the Marshals Service and the state and local law enforcement intel community, would you say?
We certainly believe that it is, and my experience has been that it is. We try very, very hard to not say no when someone calls for information from us or information sharing. In fact, we like to be among the first to step up when it comes to information sharing, to offer information we have that can be useful in a terrorism case or a something to do with homeland security. Most notably, we share what we refer to as our Warrant Information Network, our WIN system, which is just a wealth of information about individuals that are wanted currently or historical records on individuals who have been wanted. And that ties in a tremendous amount of information that can be at the access of many of the other intelligence centers. So we do pride ourselves on being a very user-friendly federal service who's willing to share what we have.
Can you give us some best practices or lessons learned type examples?
Well, I think in, just after the 9/11 incident, which tends to, of course, draw the context to how everything changed in domestic preparedness and information sharing. There's a number of federal fusion centers or intelligence centers out there where we have learned that by participating and sharing the information we have through our databases and resources, what we get in return is also very helpful to us. As I mentioned a moment ago, with the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, the DEA's fusion center, where we, are able to exchange information on back and forth that has mutual benefit to us and to the other agency sharing. So it's been a good two-way street again for us, and we find that it works well.
Now, Los Angeles and New York, their police departments, to name two departments and two municipalities, they have extensive intel experience both at home and abroad. Can you give us a sense of your information sharing relationships there with those two entities?
Well, it so happens that the Los Angeles and New York areas happen to fall within the area of jurisdiction of two of our regional task forces, fugitive task forces that tie in a number of municipalities in the greater metropolitan areas in those two places in L.A. and New York. What's happened there is their officers and detectives being assigned jointly to our task force and vice versa, with us sharing back with them, there is a great partnership there at the federal level. So in both New York and L.A., and particularly with the terrorism concerns that seem to befall those two venues, I think they're pleased to have us on board, and we're pleased to see their detectives and officers on board with us. So we have good cross-training. Information sharing there is almost, I would say, instantaneous. And my experience has been from just mitigating threats that it works very, very well.
Mm-hmm. In this segment, let's now look at how federal-level law enforcement can support state and local law enforcement and preparedness for consequence management, particularly of mass casualty incidents, natural or terrorist. I know your service is playing more of a role here. Can you tell us about that, if you would?
Well, we hopefully won't see incidents where there are mass casualties or really severe incidents like that, but history tells us that that may be the case someday. Our federal role, of course, in being sort of the enforcement arm of the Department of Justice, and again having sort of the broad context of being directed by the Attorney General to intervene whenever there's some type of a terrorist incident or mass casualties. Of course, Hurricane Katrina comes to mind. When we were sent there at the direction of the Attorney General to, in the very broad terms of his order, to restore order. That is to say, where there's looting, where there's incidents of, protecting infrastructure, national level infrastructure types, we want to provide the necessary support and law enforcement there to do that. So we are and have been playing a much larger role in that. And in more recent times, it's really not unusual anymore for the Attorney General to ask us to go out and intervene.
Now, as far as your rapid deployment teams, how many do you have? How are they equipped, and whom will they support?
Well, our rapid deployment teams, and particularly in our special operations group, while we don't necessarily talk about the numbers that we have, we do have the capability to get people and resources and equipment around the country very, very quickly. That is often in support of any type of national crisis. Some things that I would be certainly comfortable talking about is our response to the 9/11 incidents, where we made resources available quickly, again, to help mitigate any of the infrastructure collapse and concerns there. Hurricanes, natural disasters, earthquakes, even to situations that involve threats to our protectees, for example, we may want to get a team to a location very, very quickly. So we get them out there to support a wide variety of our law enforcement missions, judicial protection, fugitive apprehension. The Washington sniper case comes to mind. Terrorism incidents. And again, even things that go on within the confines of our homeland security. So we are trying to be very, very responsive and very, very fast to respond.
Now, a quick aside, you have a technology working group. What does it do, and how might it help the state and local folks in the way of developing and passing along technologies for homeland security applications?
Well, our technology working group is sort of a work in progress. We are developing and looking at sort of an R&D, if you will, the various technologies that are out there that we can use to support our missions, particularly in protecting the judiciary. All of the technologies that exist in the world now that are so rapidly advancing that we look at with a critical eye to see if that is something that we can deploy to help protect a judge or other officials that we protect. And so what we essentially did was put a working group together and asked them to look at our current capabilities, sort of the tools that we currently have in the toolbox, and ask critical questions about whether or not those types of things are adequate for today, in today's world. And if not, what should we do differently? What other kinds of things are out there that we should get or look at or explore? And so we've been doing some R&D on various types of technology and looking at ways to expand our capabilities. And it's all really designed to give us insight and ideas into improving the ways we respond to our various missions. We have a strong technology support within our fugitive apprehension mission, which is very, very critical in helping capture some of our nation's most dangerous criminals. But we're also exploring it even more so now with regard to protecting our judiciary.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosives, CBRNE, what assistance can you provide the state and local folks, both in terms of crisis response and also consequence management?
Well, in that particular area, we have developed a very good response to, you know, hazmat-type situations where it might call for something of that nature. We have developed a capability to respond, not so much, I would say, on a large national scale, just in terms of scope and size, but we do have very mission-specific capabilities that we could use and deploy to support, you know, consequence management and to help mitigate situations. For example, when we were providing security at the Zacharias Moussaoui trial in Alexandria, we were able to utilize some of the capabilities there to be ready to mitigate any type of hazmat, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear type of situation. And that included working and forming good partnerships with our military counterparts, our state and local counterparts, so that we utilize the great expertise that they already have. And most metropolitan areas have a very strong capability in this area now. And that's predominantly, I think, as a result of 9/11, but they've really made a lot of ground in this particular area, and I'm glad to see it.
Well, I have one more question, Director Clark. I know you have a great story to tell on the various assets that you brought to bear during the Hurricane Katrina response. Share a little bit about that with us before we go.
Well, of course, we all have imprinted on our memory the images that occurred there at Hurricane Katrina and the devastation that came, and particularly the flooding and, the devastation as well in southern Mississippi. We were asked to respond there by the Attorney General to bring support to the local law enforcement, as I mentioned a little bit ago, to things like moving inmates out to be secure in other facilities, to escort water convoys in that were being, in some cases early on in the incident, being hijacked, if you will, to safeguard fuel depots where fuel was at a premium. We provided infrastructure support to a number of, major, infrastructures within the greater New Orleans and southern Mississippi area. We performed waterborne rescues with the Coast Guard and others that were where we used our special operations group and some of our boats to navigate the flooded areas to actually go house to house in search of victims who could not get out. We utilized our fugitive apprehension teams to actually search for the violent criminal band, some of which showed up soon after to wreak havoc on the city, where there was groups of violent criminals that were around the city. We were helping even just with some infrastructure things, bringing water where it was needed, getting food where it was needed. So I'm very, very proud of our response. We were definitely on the front lines of that response. I remember visiting our men and women in the service who were sleeping on floors like many of the other first responders. They were dirty, not able to change their clothes for days. They're literally just had the tired look of somebody who has been working under very horrible and extreme conditions. But that is the role of the first responder these mm-hmm. days. We see that not just in the Marshals Service, but, of course, in our state and local counterparts, the true American heroes that are out there that get the job done. And I have stories of other victims who received the support from our folks in terms of food, water, shelter, being rescued. And you can only imagine their good feeling for law enforcement when you show up and are able to bring them to safety after perhaps they'd spent hours or days sitting on a roof or in a flooded area. Indeed. So it was a great story and a great thing that we're proud of, and hopefully we won't have to do anything like that down the road.
Well, Director Clark, I really appreciate the time you've taken to talk with us, and I thank you very much, and I thank you for your service to our country.
Well, thank you, and I will just say to the first responders and those who are handling our domestic preparedness out there that my hat is tipped to them for the service that they do, and across the land our country is safer and better because we are doing a much better job, I think, of communicating and working together. Thus the very reason for this interview, I think, just getting the word out that we need to do that. So I appreciate this opportunity, and thank you for having me.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
This has been a Domestic Preparedness podcast interview. Thank you for listening.